gathered. Any staff individuals, if you have a name tent, if you can grab that, please, and bring that to your place, so others can see and know who is.
I don't think I have one.
Okay, all right, so, and you can identify yourself as we go around. So, to those who are here from the community, public, let me welcome you and say that this is a meeting open to the public, but not a public meeting, meaning that the information will be covered based on the agenda and what is on the agenda, and our hope would be to give an opportunity for public testimony at the end of the agenda, and the testimony will be as it relates specifically to the items that are covered. Hopefully that makes sense. So we welcome you, glad you're here. It's important to be a part of the process and the ongoing process. I think I can say that public involvement and engagement is very important because it's of primary importance, and the chair can speak to this himself for the accountability of the Bond Oversight Committee. So I'm going to have everyone just briefly kind of introduce yourself, Bond Oversight Committee members and PHB staff members, if you would do so. And there is an ask from the Bond Oversight Committee members for Shannon Callahan, who is the staff person for the Bond Oversight Committee. So, Shannon, you want to?
Oh, good morning. I'm Shannon Callahan, Portland Housing Bureau. I'm going to give you a little notepad. We've realized that I don't have all of your contact information, and there are things that we may want to contact you about by phone. I know we have your email, but I'm just hoping that you would be so kind as to share that. I will not use it after 5 p.m. Or before 8 a.m. But
what about sirens and
stuff?
Only if I'm inviting you out for food. Thank you.
So, name, email, phone number.
Yes. The best phone number to reach you out of multiple would be really helpful. Thank you.
Perfect. And while that's happening, if you would grab your revised adopted charter first, or to adopt the charter, we'll take a few moments and look it over. Let's make sure it's saying what it should say. Does everybody have the revised charter?
Might we do introductions again, just in case?
Oh, absolutely.
Just to reinforce who does what before we jump into the charter?
Sure.
Since I opened my mouth, I should probably then proceed. So I'm Kurt Krieger, the Director of Housing for the Housing Bureau. This is clearly one of our top priorities. And I'm extremely pleased that all five members are here. Thank you very much for your time. Daivisha?
Yes. My name is Daivisha, and I support the policy and equity team as well as the BLC.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Chang. I'm with the policy team and working closely with the stakeholder advisory group of the bond.
Shannon. Michelle DePass, Community Engagement Bureau.
I'm Carl Winklesfield. I manage the multifamily development team.
Of course, I've mentioned what I did.
Stephen Green, Chair.
Jess Larson, Vice Chair.
Alan Lazo, I'm a member of the committee and the Fair Housing Council of Oregon.
Susan Emmons.
And Todd Schimble.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. Let's then take a moment to review the charter. Prepare to
It's Well, I didn't reflect the changes on the hard copy. The attachments that you guys were to receive had the changes, so I can send that to you all, but or I can print it real quick for you, but it's not reflected in the final copy. My apologies.
I think it may be helpful
yeah.
if we had it at the moment
yeah.
to just kind of compare
okay.
so that we know.
So they were track edits.
To be sure, if you have it, maybe we can actually just put it up on the screen if you've got it on your...
It's not on the USB, it's a different
oh, okay.
computer.
Do we want to move on to that, to put that to the end?
Yes, we will, but I think yeah. Alan had a question as well.
One question I had for on the first page under purpose and roles number 6, and I think I mentioned this previously, Rob, where it says make recommendations to refine the policy framework plan if needed. I think the clarification was that the recommendations were to the council rather than to the bureau.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to make sure that's
it's
clear.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think we also talked last time that one of the reasons why we're doing this meeting right now, but before it went to council, was we wanted to make our recommendation for the framework before it got adopted.
Correct.
Yeah, definitely. That.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
So therefore.
Oh, okay. So that would have not gone. Yeah.
I think we wanted to make any change. If we wanted to make any recommendations prior to going to council.
Correct.
Okay. And I was thinking that the charter would kick in after the framework plan was adopted. So this would be for?
It's an excellent question. I'm not sure.
So if I understood, you're wanting to add the words "make recommendations to refine the policy framework plan to council." So you're wanting to make sure that the recommendations you make regarding the framework plan in the future are presented to council, correct?
Is that that's the body that we're making recommendations to. Here's Stephen's point. So it does depend on when.
Well, Stephen, your point's a really good one, but your grant of authority exists with or without a framework plan. I mean, the council appointed you,
right.
And you have oversight responsibility, even absent a framework plan. The framework plan was our means by which we would create sort of the structure. So, you know, I think this can be adopted prior to council enacting a framework plan.
Yeah. But after the framework is adopted by council,
right, and that's what we're going to talk about today is the framework plan and go over the recommendations and what we've heard. And then, yes, it is going to be a lot of work.
So if everyone is okay with it, I would suggest we're a couple minutes early, but since we don't have the kind of ability to evaluate this revised charter against the prior charter, if we can just go into the framework plan. Jennifer's here to kind of walk us through that. And if you're okay, if everyone's okay with that, then we'll come back to the charter itself. Yeah? Okay, perfect. Jennifer.
Okay, great. So I think since your last meeting, since that time, the stakeholder advisory group completed its 8th meeting and was able to finalize a draft policy framework for the bond. And over the last several weeks, we've been collecting different community comments on that. And Michelle and Sia are going to provide an update of that information we've collected in a little later in our meeting. But I wanted to spend some time to just walk through the summary of what's in the draft policy framework. You have copies of the full plan. Have you each been able to see the framework, the full framework plan prior to today, or no?
I have not.
Okay. So you have the full copy in front of you, which is a 25-page document, and you can review that, you know, I think after this meeting, but I'll go through some of the main highlighted areas, and then we can spend some time having discussion, questions, and then follow-ups in terms of different areas of it. So just a brief overview of the timeline. Back in November, voters passed the bond, obviously. And then earlier this year in March, the mayor's office and through PHB convened the bond stakeholder advisory group. Both Alan and Jess are part of that group and participated in several of those meetings. And
from April through August, so it was a several month period. We had a total of 8 meetings, and the main purpose of this group was to advise and guide the Bureau and the city in setting up the policy priorities and kind of the guidelines around how bond investments should be made. And so there was a set of questions we went through around communities and prioritize communities and kind of where to focus investments with the bond. And so we'll go over some of those main highlights. As I mentioned earlier, since late August through just this past Saturday, we've been collecting community feedback on the draft plan. So we're in the process of, we've compiled much of it, but, and still in the process of compiling it as we've received some feedback as recent as yesterday. And we'll be presenting that, compiling it by this week, and we have a final stakeholder advisory group meeting tomorrow, which will be reviewing this. And then our plan is to finalize, compile the comments, make final revisions to the plan, finalize it, and it will go before City Council. October 11th is the current date. I think it's a 2 o'clock, is it?
Yes.
A 2 o'clock in the afternoon time where it will be on City Council's agenda. So that's just kind of a overview of the timeline. So the framework plan itself is about 25 pages. It's broken out into these main categories of guiding principles, production goals, priority communities, location priorities, set of guidelines for development, operations and services, and then finally reporting metrics and community engagement guidelines. And so I'll go over these highlighted areas to give you a summary of what's contained in the plan, and I think in particular for this committee, we'd also like to take some time looking at the reporting metrics that have been proposed as the committee, as your committee, you'll be, overseeing the progress of bond investments throughout, the next several years.
So. And with reporting metrics, the SAG did acknowledge that you are the committee that will be taking up that task, and so they made recommendations with full awareness that that you have the ability to adapt that change, ask for more information. So I think they're recommendations to you, but just wanted to make sure that you know at any time if you need additional information, that is within your purview.
So with the production goals, the plan states that the goal is to create and acquire a total of 1,300 affordable housing units. For those who were really closely connected in the public campaign for the bond, this number was promoted as a goal around the bond. And so we want to create at least 1,300 units. All of the units and apartments will be affordable for households who are at or below 60% of area median income. Again, this is consistent with the act that the voters passed. And so that's roughly 45,000 for a family of four or below. 600 units will be deeply affordable. So that's for households that are not earning income or income up to 30% area median income. So about 22,000 for a family of four. And then 650 units will be larger family size units, so 2 to 3 bedrooms. What we heard a lot in our stakeholder advisory group and also in our community feedback is, even larger size apartments are often, we have a gap for that, particularly for families, intergenerational families. For priority communities, there's a focus to create housing opportunities for families and individuals who have been impacted by racism, housing discrimination, homelessness, and displacement. So particularly these communities, so communities of color, recognizing that this is a very diverse group that also contains many communities, so 5 culturally specific communities and immigrant and refugee communities. Also families, acknowledging families is also including intergenerational households. Households experiencing homelessness or at imminent risk of becoming homeless, and then households facing imminent displacement. So these are the four main priority communities. There are two specific target alignment of units connected to these. The first is with communities of color, having 850 units connected or aligned with culturally specific partners or other community agencies, particularly in thinking about outreach, marketing, and then connection of services for households who are served housed. And then the second is alignment of 400 units specifically with the homeless service system, of which at least 300 would be permanent supportive housing. So this is for this would be for households that are experiencing homelessness, oftentimes chronic homelessness, and with a disability, and having kind of availability of support services for the duration of their housing. And with the supportive housing and PSH commitment, it's important that it is a source of the services portion will be funded through a non-bond source, since the bond funds themselves are specifically and only can be paying for the capital expenses of the housing. So for location priorities, there was a variety of important things identified through the stakeholder advisory group. The first was to focus investments in areas of high opportunity. So building and acquiring housing in economically and racially diverse neighborhoods. And then another was to look at building and producing and acquiring housing in areas where there aren't current public housing and resource investments. So one example is the urban renewal area funds is one fund that we currently have, and it's focused in certain geographic areas. So the recommendation is looking at using bond funds outside of those areas, right, to be able to build housing in those areas outside of current housing resources. Leading with racial equity in land and building acquisition decisions, and then also factoring in data such as school capacity or mobility rates as an important factor for prioritizing areas. And then another priority was balancing investments throughout the geographic area of the city, and then also preventing gentrification, using bond funds to prevent gentrification and displacement so that it could stabilize current residents. So there, I think I mentioned before, the bond funds can be used for capital only, and also any construction projects with bond funds need to be owned by the city, and they're subject to public contracting code and procurement laws. And so I think a lot of the discussion with the stakeholder group was around how can the city and how can we use these bond funds to really utilize the expertise of our community partners and existing nonprofit development capacity. And so I think that was a reoccurring theme in a lot of our discussions. There was also other strategies that the group identified that we should focus on, and these are four of those main ones. One is to focus on looking at achieving greater equity and access to development opportunities. So this could be looking at different partners, doing kind of really focused outreach to culturally specific partners, both developers and service partners, around the creation of housing that's culturally appropriate in both design and also in the form of it. Using bond funds to advance and kind of increase community benefits. So it includes DMW ESB as well as workforce training and hiring policies. Again, building on partnerships that utilize our existing community expertise and experience, and replicating local best practices. And then also streamlining processes for greater speed of development. I think this is always a goal, like that we could look to see how we can quicken the pace of development. And then there were several guidelines for operations of the housing. I just wanted to highlight the tenant. Oh, what happened? The tenant screening policies. That there are several priorities that the criteria should be and have, which are affirmatively furthering fair housing. It should advance racial equity and be low barrier, meaning accessible for people with a lot of barriers to housing. Provide a supportive path for credit and debt issues. Be transparent, understandable, and linguistically appropriate. And then also utilize best practices. And so again, the framework plan doesn't lay out the specific criteria. So this is guidelines for how that criteria and policy should look. And that is work that the Bureau, along with their partners, we're working on, you know, at this time. And then for services, just that the city will continue to collaborate and coordinate with local, state, and federal partners around opportunity to leverage resources and funding with existing systems. And also, we'll continue to build upon and create new partnerships with both culturally specific partners, homeless service partners, and others to support access and services and stability, you know, for the households served. And then there are some guidelines around services. Resident services will be culturally responsive and culturally specific based on the needs of the residents. And there's a wide range of services that can be available for resident services, and they may include some of these, you know, such as eviction prevention, workforce and employment services, financial literacy, childcare, legal advocacy, and then parenting and youth activities. And this is just obviously a partial list, and it's very much dependent on who will be housed in that particular property or community. And then there's some guidelines around supportive housing services. And again, culturally responsive and culturally specific and delivered with a housing first approach. And some of the services may include mental health counseling and treatment, alcohol and drug recovery, healthcare, peer delivered services. This again is just not a full list, but some of the services that may be available. So I think I will skip that part.
I guess it's like to take the survey.
Yeah, and we'll go over that. But I guess questions on these components first, or the things that I just went over, and then I think would also like to spend a few minutes looking at the reporting metrics and getting your thoughts on that. So.
Just in general, I haven't had a chance to review some of this, but it just strikes me that there's so many goals and so many overlays trying to be achieved, which I think are good. But I guess my overriding question is, I feel such a sense of urgency about getting the housing online and trying to meet all these goals. Could somebody around the table tell me, is that going to slow down the process of getting this housing built?
Well,
or acquired?
I don't think so. We share your sense of urgency, and it's one of the reasons why we moved on the Allington within a week of the voter-approved ballot measure. It's important you know that we had a 15-day due diligence period, and that ended less than 2 weeks after the ballot was approved. So we moved as expeditiously as humanly possible to get that done. It's also important you know that in this hiatus, we've not lost any opportunities because of process or because of the need to include a lot of voices. We've continued to maintain open relationships with sellers of property, with developers of property, and while we can't allocate monies, we can't make commitments. The door is ajar and has been ajar for the last 8 months, 10 months. As soon as the city council approves the framework plan, we'll open a transaction window. And I've asked staff to be prepared to do that on October 20th, so that prior to the one-year anniversary of the voter-approved ballot measure, that there will be work will be flowing. I can't really do it before then because the city council may choose to redirect us or to focus our energies in a slightly different manner, so I don't want to make assumptions about the council. But I think we're ready to rock. Now, as soon as we're told to go, we'll go.
The only question I had was, does the Ellington project align with the production goals?
Yes, I think it does. It's 263 units, 44 of which were preserved through an adjudicated settlement, which some of you may have something to do with, predated my being here. So we're not actually counting the 44 to our 1,300 goal, because we think that would be perhaps disingenuous, because they're already protected by virtue of that agreement. It's also been a good sort of learning laboratory for the staff to work through some of the asset management issues. For example, vacancies are being placed through the county's homeless assistance referral system, and extremely low-income folks who have been displaced and have been homeless are being placed in the Ellington through that arrangement. The joined up services are still being assembled, and the asset management protocols with Home Forward and the attachment of the project-based units to those units is still being worked on. So we meet every week with Home Forward on this, and we have a mutual shared responsibility with the providers as well. So I think it's playing out fine. It's allowed us to bench test some of these policies in practice at the same time to make sure we're not off track.
So how many of the units are 2 and 3 bedrooms?
They're predominantly two. Carl might remember.
Yeah, so of the 263, it's somewhere 200 plus or 2 and 3 bedrooms. Yeah, there are very few studios. They don't, I think, only 2 or 3 studios.
So that's like a third of that goal.
It's a large majority of beds. Mostly 2. So we haven't implemented the affordability restrictions there yet. I think the report yesterday was 16 of the vacancies we've had since we bought it are filled with folks from the referral system.
We've been planning on it. I think Susan, you asked for a full update on the Ellington, and I think we should give you a full update on the Ellington and a written response with all of this information for you. But 80 of the units are slated to be 0 to 30, and we worked with Home Forward on that number. Primarily, they had some concerns about the overlaying of vouchers and the concentration of poverty issues in that particular zip code. And I believe that our proportion mirrors the portion of expectations from vouchers versus what the Housing Bureau is supposed to do without vouchers. So the two-thirds amount, right? Two-thirds are coming from vouchers and one-third is coming from just the asset themselves. So
that is great. I mean, what I've heard from the homeless provider system is they reached out to the building management, and they in response have been very responsive and being very clear when their vacancies and also their screening criteria, and that sound good and low barrier. And I think that's good in practice to see that. And because people in the homeless service system are so desperate for housing, they reach out. As soon as there's a new opportunity, they're there. And as soon as the people are ready to talk, and my understanding is that that's going well, and they're being very transparent as vacancies come up and explaining to the system how these subsidies are going to be applied to lower the rent as the units. So I see that as a plus already. I'd love to see the written report.
Thank you, Susan.
Yeah.
We're happy to hear the positive
feedback. Yeah, that's really helpful to hear. Yep.
we intentionally reached out to them.
Primarily right after the 0-30, we're reaching out to the homeless family system to fill that vacancy. So it's a good partnership. And I, you know, the entire team, I'm looking in the back to Javier Mena, the other assistant director, who's really taken that on the connection. So I wanted to acknowledge Javier in the back of the room. his team's good work on that.
And can I follow up on Steve? Is part of your question around the other parts of the criteria at all? So I'm sort of curious about that, about how the Ellington is landing based on our location priorities. I don't know if that's your thoughts as far as reporting out, since it is part of that production goal. So I'm curious whether or not you consider how it fits in those other priorities. You don't have to answer that now, but as far as the written report, if there's a way to address those
I think that some of the survey questions that we've done, I don't know if you had a chance to take the online survey, but we tried to adapt the questions specifically to where we found the SAG was struggling, and you know there was quite a bit of agreement on a variety of different issues. There are some different folks bring different opinions, but the location priorities were really, really an area that I think the committee struggled with for 3 or 4 different meetings. And so we actually asked direct information in our surveys about that, because we thought that, it was, we also asked about priority communities, but really we tried to address some of the issues that the SAG had struggled with. And so I think you'll see a little bit about what that gives us. And I think Ellington is, one dot on the map to help us fill in some of the other pieces.
Yeah, so I think that narrative.
Yeah, and I think in our report out, we can also include, related to the priority communities, what we know the demographics of both that area, as well as who is currently housed. Yeah.
I think another thing that would be helpful for the group is you mentioned urban rural areas, and by law, they have the city. But I think doing a deeper dive, as we did earlier in the week, not all of the urban areas have money. So Interstate, the largest one in the state, has no money for housing for the next 3 years. So when we talk about making investments in areas that don't have TIF, I think it's one thing to bring up is we have urban areas that do not have a dime for housing for the foreseeable future. And so I think it'd be great to maybe do a breakdown of the next 5-year budget when it comes to housing for the 7 URAs or 8 URAs, whatever they are. Just high level so they can kind of be able to take a look at that. And be able to identify opportunities where, that means no one's got some money. That one has nothing.
Well,
some
never
can
be
commercial.
Right.
And that's a good part of the conversation that SAG actually. We have seen some of those numbers. It's part of the budget part. Yeah.
Jess has her placard up.
I had a question about the tenant screening policy list of goals. One that I guess I've been assuming all along the way, but isn't explicitly written, is seeking universal criteria, so streamlined criteria for all of these projects. And I guess that my assumption leads me to a question. Was that a false assumption? Is that something that the Bureau has been striving to or envisioning also, that all of these bond projects would have some sort of universal criteria so that it's streamlined for access?
So we are actually in the process. One of the things in the SAG framework that was clear is with all that was to be discussed, talking about tenant screening and issues around over-income tenants, we really needed to have a deeper dive into. And so we've, with the support of the mayor's office, we're going to be convening some work groups to help us work exactly on some of those questions. I'm not sure that we have set our minds to whether universal criteria for all buildings would be, is where we would be going necessarily. I honestly don't know that we have an opinion on whether universal criteria is appropriate. I know various buildings that are nonprofit and partners like Home Forward run have different screening criteria based on the various populations and services that they're trying to provide. So I don't know that we necessarily have that goal in mind. I think we want to see more information. That said, I do think there are certain things that we want to be consistent across all of our properties. So, so yes, I think a little bit, and we don't necessarily know that, but we are going to be asking SAG members and some other community members to help us really work and perfect these issues, because one of the things we need to be clear on is what those are, and we need to be clear with you and the public and everyone seeking what those screening criteria are or are not.
I'd like to add to that a little bit. I do think there are some things that will be shared across the platform, and not just the bond finance platform, but all PHP supported properties. But as we have an expressed interest in focusing on certain communities, there may be gradations. For example, if there was an effort with a domestic violence provider, and we know we have a site next to the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence, for example, which the Bureau already owns, and if that property were then fully built with bond funds, there would likely be a separate set of criteria for a property at the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence, because it would be a service-enriched site next to the Justice Center, which would be particularly helpful for women who've been displaced, victims of domestic violence, survivors of domestic violence, and their children. But it may not be the right place for everybody. And we have to thread, obviously, the concerns of fair housing into that. But there may be specific properties and specific locations that have different screening criteria by virtue of the provider's goals. And we've already stated emphatically that whatever happens at the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence will be in consultation with them, because they're currently using the site for a portion of the site for parking. So it has to be sort of symbiotic. So I just point that out as one instance where there might be a slightly different approach. It might include site-based waiting lists. It might not be a universal waiting list, for example.
I guess as a comment, if I might, it makes sense that in trying to successfully serve certain populations, there would be criteria that was extremely reduced or extremely sensitive. But perhaps there's a way to have a minimum set of criteria across the table without evictions and credit and criminal histories that's as low as possible.
Yeah, I think that's where I agree too. There is that baseline best practices that the Bureau overall should lead in.
I like how you say that.
There was a mention, Director Krieger.
Yes.
You mentioned about meeting with Home Forward on a weekly basis. Is that specifically related to the Ellington?
We meet with Home Forward every week for all sorts of things, but this has been a deep dive into how we, they have to actually underwrite the project-based rental assistance vouchers and attach them to a unit and conduct an analysis. They have to do a fair housing impact assessment to make sure that we're not creating a pocket of poverty, for example. So synchronizing their staff work and our staff work is quite important. We're taking that further with respect to asset management. So we're trying to leverage the relationship. They are the Housing Authority of Portland. No matter what they do business as, they are, you know, they were created by the City of Portland, and we want to make sure that we're working closely with them. And it may include co-development activities so that we are working in partnership on specific projects. And it's probably worth mentioning at this juncture, I know Alan and Jess have tracked this more closely, but the framework plan, I call this Bond 1.0, because this is the unleveraged model. The framework plan talks at some length about the need for constitutional amendments so that we can leverage tax credits and we can do business with what the state considers to be artificial entities, which would be partnerships, corporations, trusts, limited liability companies. And that will likely be proffered as a constitutional amendment. It was Shannon was part of a panel testifying last week to Representative Kenny Geyer's Human Service and Housing Committee on this very subject. If it passes in the 2018 session, it would be proffered to the voters. It doesn't go into effect until it's approved at a general election. The soonest would be November of 2018. So if that were to happen, we would have a framework plan 2.0 that would switch to a more leveraged model, which also then expands the universe of partners. So we're working closely with Home Forward today because they're a governmental entity and we can do business with them under the strictures of the Constitution. We can't do business with limited liability companies and tax credit partnerships, but were that constitutional amendment to be created, then there will be a hybridization of how we leverage additional monies. And we'll obviously bring that back to you, and that'll have to be a very open, transparent process.
Thank you. Thank you for expanding on that. I think it was important before.
I do have a specific question.
Yes.
So this is for Jennifer, because you were covering the, so when you're talking about the priority communities and you're talking about the households experiencing homelessness, in your presentation you have, it's aligned 400 units with homeless service resources, and so I'm not sure exactly how that's implemented, but then in the framework, it has the minimum target of 400 units at 0 to 30% AMI, which is a subset of the 600 0 to 30s. Right? So are those 400s the same thing?
Is 400 part of the 600?
Yeah.
400 is part of the 600, but is this one, it says align.
Yep.
So I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean geographically, or?
It means in terms of, so those would primarily be the zero, yeah, so there's 600 of the total produced that are aimed to be deeply affordable, right? The 0 to 30%. So of that 600, at least 400 of them will be aligned in the sense of working in coordination with homeless service system partners. Like, I think one good example is, like, you know, direct referrals through the homeless family system, coordinated access, which is an existing waiting list, right? So I think it's saying, yeah, of the 600, you know, deeply affordable, at least 400 will have some direct coordination with the homeless. Yeah, because you know, the Home for Everyone Coordinating Board actually submitted a request recommendation that all 600 of the 0 to 30 be aligned with homeless service system partners. And I think in a lot of our discussion, as you were sitting at the table, you know, that's really important. And there's also a need for the deeply affordable housing, and not everyone is connected through the homeless service system, right? So
I'm wondering if it's maybe a change actually in the framework plan. It's on page 7 under section 5 of priority communities, because that it does say here minimum target 400 units at 0 to 30% AMI. And I'm wondering if it should actually say what you have in the presentation that actually should be the wording there should be aligned with homeless service. I think that the intention is that, because this is the section that talks about a home for everyone, which is where we're coordinating, you know, those PSH dollars and such, but I'm just not clear if the intention there is really only to mean 0 to 3% AMI, but I think what it actually means is homeless services, right?
Yeah,
you have
that's
the presentation.
Right. That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I can make that. Do you want
a
clarification? Yeah.
Yeah, if you see what I'm at, it's
page 7.
Page 7 in section 5, it's the fourth bullet. Make a visible impact of homelessness through alignment of homeless service system resources. And then the parenthesis says minimum target of 400 units at 0 to 30% AMI. But again, that's only that's a subset of 600. I think what you actually mean is that to align those 400 with the homeless service.
That's right. Yeah, so we could
rather
take out the 0 to 30.
AMI.
Right. Yeah. I think. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
I had a question about the PSH, the push for PSH units within the bond money. Is that based on an evaluation that's been very effective for populations? And then it sounds like what you're saying is other resource has to come to the table for the service model that supports a permanent supportive housing. So would you imagine a developer coming forward and already having that in place? Like, would there be an RFP specifically, and then someone would have to come forward and already have that in the mix of what they're offering up?
It would be multi-pronged, I think. Yes, it is effective, and the city has funded some 800 permanent supportive housing units already, 700 of which are currently in service, and some are well known by Clark Common, some are less well known and distributed throughout the city. So no one within the city, at least, argues about its usefulness and effect. The big issue for us has always been, if we're going to make a bond commitment of 300 units, and the bonds are outstanding for 20 years, then we need a service commitment for 20 years. It's about a $45 million service commitment. And the mayor has indicated that since those services are mostly mental health, alcohol, addiction, substance abuse, recovery, and public health, then the services need to come from the county. And there needs to be a sustainable funding source attached to it. In other words, it can't be subject to annual appropriation, and we start off with 3 years of support services, and then when you do your audit at year five, you find out that none of the PSH units have services attached to them. That would not be a good outcome. So we need to work through that issue, and the chair and the mayor are closely involved with this, and I think their channels of communication are open. It will likely involve a new dedicated funding source, and how that gets funded and by whom and when and how is all very, very much timely. Because I don't think anybody believes that they can carve $45 million out of existing programs and make it work. Most places that have done this, Los Angeles, King County, have done so with voter approval. So as far as who delivers it, I think it goes back to my earlier point about whether we can do business with artificial entities or not, right? If we can work with nonprofit corporations, which are artificial entities, and they would likely be directly involved as either building owners, sponsors, perhaps developers. If we have to stay with the current construct, then it will be through service contracts. And it will have to be braided through Multnomah County in order for it to be sufficient and effective.
Todd, you've been silent the entire time. Any questions?
I did have some questions about the location. Maybe it's brought up when we were talking about that. But my questions were, in the framework, it looks like there's a distinction between building and land acquisition. And I was wondering for a little clarity on that. I mean, my understanding is the bond is to build units. Are there instances, it sounds like this is transit development, maybe getting some land that may not be built by the affordable bond? Is that kind of the intention?
No. The intention was, I think, to distinguish between the concept of acquiring units where people are currently living in them. So an acquisition rehabilitation concept where we're going out and working to prevent displacement and rent increases and stabilize the renters. And then when we refer to land, we are talking about land that we will then develop into a new construction project. So that is what we're trying to differentiate. There is no intent to land bank under the affordable housing bond. Any land that is acquired with bond funds would be the intent. So that's literally what we were trying to distinguish.
Okay.
Before I believe the SAG is trying to disappear.
And then I guess the other question I have with respect to that location is, are these in order of importance? That was unclear because it sounded like there were more factors within the PowerPoint. But this in the actual framework, there's really only three. And it seems like there's, I don't know if it's ranked in terms of these are, we want, this, like the areas of risk of high risk of gentrification displacement are prioritized over things like transportation or school catchment areas with the highest mobility rates. I'm just curious about that. If there is no ranking, or if it's just.
I think that the SAG wrestled with this as, because there were several really important priorities identified
several in which are somewhat in conflict one with one another. And the group was very, I would say there was strong consensus around the first leading with racial equity in terms of that particular analysis and lens in all acquisition decisions. And then I don't believe, I mean, they're not necessarily in ranked order after that, other than I think there was just really clear direction that regardless in either acquisition of buildings, existing buildings, or new construction, use the racial equity analysis and lens first, you know, and then, yeah, I don't know, but.
There's no official, I mean, it sounds like there's, from the stakeholder advisory committee, there was really strong consent, like, prioritize that one in particular.
Yes.
But then after that, there's not.
Yes, there. Provide some flexibility for the city to, and, you know, I don't know.
I would agree with that. I think that captures it well, Jennifer. And because the intention certainly is to lead with that, then where the conflict comes in, for instance, is we might have areas that are at risk for displacement that don't already have investments in high opportunity. So how do we weigh those two things? You know, as far as where would we put a new development? Do we want to then move it to an area that might have higher opportunity but not contain those communities of color anymore? That's a struggle. I think the intention was certainly to lead with that piece around racial equity and really look at those communities and then see how we can fit the other pieces in together.
Well, we've come to our break. If there aren't any other questions related to, and we can always pick it back up. We'll take a 5-minute break and we will come back together. Please take advantage of the coffee and water and pastries.
I save all those stuff back. I think it was.
Yeah.
I'm going to see if I can get a zip drive. Can I take that zip drive?
Yeah. Do you need another one?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I have one in my
list. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, good. Okay.
I gave you this.
Right.